Today's topic is, there's a story behind that, and there's a story behind that topic. We were having a conversation yesterday here in Washington State, my daughter Lisa, my wife Marianne, and we were talking about a ring that Lisa had given to her daughter Megan. And you can imagine that if you just give a ring to a person, you just give a ring to a person, just a solid object that goes on somebody's finger. But there was a story behind the ring. And part of the story that I heard, there was more to it than the initial story that I heard. And we got to talking about the way we convey information, not only to another person, but to ourselves. We tell stories. And so that's where we're headed today. You can already know that when somebody is a good storyteller, they are pretty intriguing. They are captivating. They hold our attention. And storytellers and stories have entertained and informed human beings for thousands upon thousands of years. And there were stories about storytellers sitting around campfires or in caves, reciting epic stories of other people in the tribe or in the world and so on. All of these stories have been passed on in various forms over the years. And it's absolute essential to human life to transfer information using this medium of stories. I could say that stories are the glue that hold the facts together and make them more interesting and certainly easier to remember. I think we could say that our lives are stories. I think we could even go a little bit further and say our bodies are stories. We could look at our body right now, say our hands or our arms or knees, and find a scar or some other physical characteristic. And we could probably talk about that. We could tell a story about those things. Even if you just looked at your fingernails, you'd be able to go, I probably could talk about my fingernails. I could weave a story around them. And I think this is a really important idea about the way we think and hold on to information and transfer information to other people. I have a scar on my arm, my right arm. It's a forearm shaped like a canoe about an inch and a half long. So there, you got the facts. I have a scar on my right forearm about an inch and a half long, shaped like a canoe. Period. End of story. Not that interesting, not that important. Maybe useful if you were trying to identify my body if I died and said, oh, he has a scar on his right forearm. But there is a story behind that that has probably impacted other people's lives and my family when it occurred. I'm not going to bother with that story, but just know that there is one. We are our stories. Our stories, the ones that are told to us, the ones we make up, the ones we practice, shape our lives. And you can imagine somebody is describing our pregnancy when our mother was pregnant with us. They have stories about that, how easy, how difficult. Sometimes there are stories about our birth process, how easy, how difficult, how long, how short, the circumstances surrounding that. You know, maybe when the water broke, our mothers were at a party or in the hospital totally prepared or whatever. But there are stories surrounding that. And there are stories we've been told about our earliest years because consciously we're not able to remember those. And so people deliver information to us about us in story form, which we take in, we hold on to, and we use it as fabric in building our own identities. When we have what I refer to as energy exchange experiences, this is when we put our attention on anything, we are taking in energy through our eyes, perhaps through our ears, maybe touch or taste or smell, or sensing on some other level. We're taking in energy. We're exchanging energy with our environments. That's the fact. Now, how we interpret that, the conclusions we draw about our environment and ourselves, that's where the story making really kicks into high gear. And this is particularly important depending on our ability to process information. We can use our stories, and frankly, we do, to make decisions about what is possible in our lives. The stories either expanded our sense of our potential, or the stories we've heard have kind of reduced our respect or belief in our potential. Oh, you can't do that. Oh, you're not good at that, and that sort of thing. Those are the stories we've been told and we have told ourselves, and you can hear it in people's conversations. When the subject of what's possible comes up, you start hearing, limitations and so on, you know that the stories they have been told and are telling themselves up to this day are holding them back. They are literally using their own stories to keep themselves stuck in place. And when we do that, what we want to do, of course, is become aware that that's really what's happening, and then turn around and go, there's got to be a better way to do this. We can maybe accept that stories are true, generally speaking, but if we go to the movies, for instance, or watch a television program, we go, well, that's not necessarily true. It's make-believe, and all these people are actors. This is not a true story. It's a pretend or fabricated story. And that's a good idea to recognize the difference between something that's factually true and something that's fabricated. But because these facts are woven into stories, it starts to take on an idea that, this is really true, or this could really happen, or this is something I need to be concerned about. Being able to distinguish between the truth of this and the falseness of it is really important in terms of our ability to perceive and question and think and arrive at some sort of conclusion that supports us. Millions of people watch television. Millions of people watch TV news, and they think what they're watching and hearing are true stories of what's going on the planet. However, because there are 6.5 billion of us on the planet, the stories that are chosen to describe human life are automatically tilted, slanted, simply because you can't report 6.5 billion stories. Then somebody crossed the street today, somebody did a kindness to somebody else, because it's not dramatic enough, scary enough, emotionalized enough for them to attract viewers. So news organizations and stations have a specific agenda. They use stories to attract viewers, and they use those viewers to attract advertising revenue, so that their agenda is profit driven. So the stories that they select and use to give to us, to scare us, to inform us, to manipulate us, to misinform us, are really based upon their self-interest much more than ours. So when you're looking at news, and if you ever talk to anybody who's worked in a news organization for a television program, for instance, by and large, they'll say, whatever you do, don't believe what you hear, because it is all manipulated and it's all slanted. Lots of stories are distorted, not only told by other people, but the ones that we tell ourselves. Look at advertising, too. The next time you watch TV, try this. Look at the ad and see if you can discern the story there, what that story is, how you can go from this particular problem to this happy ending if you use whatever the product is that they happen to be promoting in that advertising. If you do this as you watch it, the ad, what I do is I hit the mute button, so if I'm watching it at all, I'm certainly not hearing anything. And it's kind of interesting, but you can see the story and what they're trying to appeal to. Driving a car really, really fast is appealing to a particular point of view. The people that are telling themselves that, oh, driving really fast is a cool thing. I want to be able to drive really fast because that's part of the identity, part of the story that I tell myself, that this is a good thing. Hard for me to believe in day and age of gasoline where a gallon is approaching $4, that driving fast just for the sake of driving fast makes good sense. But people tell themselves amazing varieties of story. A lot of people think that when they tell themselves stories about what we're experiencing, let's say, okay, this is what I'm experiencing, we think we're reporting facts to ourselves. I don't think so. We're not doing that. We're not reporting facts. We are presenting a slanted view of what is going on. And not only are we not reporting, more importantly, we are commanding. We are commanding ourselves to be or to do or to have according to the story that we're now telling ourselves. And if we recognize that we're not just reporting a fact, but in fact commanding future being, doing, and having, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, this is more serious than I thought. Yes, it is. Because stories are alive. Stories are causative. They're kind of like seeds that we take and plant in the garden, and then as we add energy to them, it's as if we water them and fertilize them, and they continue to grow and grow, and then show up as physical manifestations. And when we repeatedly think and emotionalize our thinking around the seed thoughts that we've planted, then when it shows up, we oftentimes surprised, wow, why me? How did this occur? I don't understand this. We grew these conditions by using stories to energize them. You know that stories are alive if you listen to somebody tell the same story multiple times, and you'll go, wow, things were added, things were omitted, things were exaggerated, things were understated. All kinds of stuff goes on. And that story can grow and grow, depending on the receptivity of the audience oftentimes. Stories, frankly, can be like nutrition. They can have nutritional value that help us to grow spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically, grow in terms of our family, grow in terms of our careers and financially and so on. They can really sustain us because we will, depending on the energy that we're putting into that story, we will grow in that particular direction. On the other hand, stories can also be toxic. So literally, if the story we tell ourselves or the story that we hold on to that somebody else told us about us, that it limits our potential. It makes us feel bad about ourselves, as if we have limitations, we have deficiencies, we have flaws. Now all of a sudden, as we keep adding energy to that, we're literally sabotaging our opportunity for happiness. We are interfering with ourselves because we're watering the weeds instead of watering the stories that would naturally grow into health, happiness, success, prosperity, love, and so on. And so we're watering the weeds, and these weeds, those weed thoughts, those stories, subvert and drain our energy, and in fact interfere with our success and our health. I think we can examine our lives, look at our lives in any one of what I refer to as the 12 worlds, the spiritual world, the mental, the emotional, the physical, the family world, career world, financial world, social world, leisure world, community, political, and maintenance worlds. Look at any one of those that you want to and see how the conditions are showing up for you today. I say, if the conditions we are experiencing in any area of our lives are not to our liking, it's because the stories that we were holding on to and are telling ourselves on a daily basis don't support our growth in that area. We're doing at least two things. We're telling ourselves damaging stories that handicap or hold us back. And number two, this is a great opportunity to say, I need to start telling myself stories that support me. I need to tell myself different stories that talk about my potential. I'm a fan of Abraham Hicks. Abraham Hicks, on February 9th, 2011, had this daily quote, and these quotes are free, so Abraham-Hicks is a good place to go to have these free daily quotes, they're fantastic, sent to you. If you will let your dominant intention be to revise and improve the content of the story you tell every day of your life, it is our absolute promise to you that your later life will become the ever-improving story. For by the powerful law of attraction, the essence of that which is like unto itself is drawn, it must be. If we want a different life, we need to tell ourselves a different story. I want to talk about memories for a few minutes. Memories are, the way I want to look at them today, are the building blocks of story. It's like, well, I remember this. I got one little memory, one little memory, one little memory, and I'm going to weave them together, and I'm going to make up a story. And I think what we do is we take these memories and then we create these stories as a result of these energy exchange experiences. In psychology, I got this definition from Wikipedia, convenient, not necessarily the most authoritative source in the world, that memory is the organism's ability to store, retain, and recall information and experiences. It's like, okay, I've got this information that I stored. I had an experience, and okay. That experience means I've exchanged energy with something, with my environment, with people, with objects, with ideas. And that incoming energy, I'll call them, as Bruce Lipton does, environmental signals, right? Light, sound, smell, taste, touch, that sort of thing, pressure, or any other perceptions that we have, and we have others beyond the five senses, that we process that information according to our ability to process information. Some people can look at something and colorblindness, for instance, and not notice what the color is. They don't see. They're not able to distinguish energetically or because of their wiring, if you will, what color is what, which color. So that processing of information, I think many of us are limited in one way or another. For instance, I can't hear music and then play it. So I can hear it, and I can appreciate it, and I can enjoy it, but I can't hear it and then sit down at the piano and play it. I would say that processing information usually involves taking value from that information and then getting rid of or letting go of what we don't want or don't value. So we take in energy, we take in information, and then we extract value and let go of what no longer serves us. And you could all of a sudden say, wow, that sounds like digestion and elimination. And that actually sounds like examples of bonding, rejecting. Eating a banana and throwing away the banana peel are an obvious example of that. Eat the part that benefits us and we let go of the part that doesn't. And then bodily elimination is also, as a result of metabolism, letting go of what no longer serves us. Perceiving and then giving value or giving meaning to the information are what we do as human beings. These are essential activities. We give meaning. We perceive and then give meaning to that which we're perceiving. I think all living organisms do that. It's just a question of degree. And we have presumably the highest capability in this regard of living organisms on the planet. But that ability to perceive, give value and meaning to information that we perceive is really what determines the quality of our lives, the amount of success that we experience, our health, and our happiness. So all of a sudden it's like, whoa, that's how we do it? By our perceptions and the meanings we give to the information we're perceiving? That's how we do it. That's how we do it. All organisms that are living have this capability to distinguish between pain and other physical sensations. I'll call it pain and not pain, or pain and pleasure, or it could be anything. Just those represent those two ends of the spectrum, if you will. Perceiving the threat of pain, and by extension, what that pain, if left unlimited and it continued and continued, intensified and intensified, we recognize that, pain is on the road to, if not corrected or handled, on the road to death. And there are two main ways to perceive pain. One, go experience it currently, directly, right now in present time. This would be like walking over to a hot stove and placing our hand on it. We're like, that's pain. Ouch. That amount of energy coming out of those coils or that fire on that stove would be more than the living cells in our hands, the skin of our hands, could tolerate. And that threat to survival is transmitted through our nervous system. And all of a sudden, we would recognize, wow, having pain in a case like that is really could be life-saving. So we pull it back before real damage is done to the hand. So that extreme amount of energy being transferred from the stove to our hand is what alerts us, and that pain sensation. The second thing is we can refer to stored memories. If we have seen somebody put his or her hand on a hot stove, or we've watched a video of it, or saw it in a movie, or can even sense it, we don't have to relive it in present time. We can use that memory as our source of information. This is a key point. This is how we live. This is how we do things. This is how memories can serve us. It's also how memories can be problematic for us. If the memory says, hot stove, hand, not a good combination, and we recognize that, and now we don't put our hand on that stove, we've used that memory as our source of information. Physiologically, it's been shown that you can have somebody wired to all kinds of instrumentation and have them experience a sensation in present time, and you can measure it. And then you can have them imagine it, that is, connect to a memory that they've stored, and they could recall that memory, and the instrumentation will essentially show an identical vibrational pattern that says the real event and the recalled event, that is the memory, are identical in nature. The body doesn't have some sort of a way to distinguish from real and imagined. They essentially are equal. So we could say that our survival instinct or our survival need or the impulse to survive has not only advanced to be able to tell pain when it's happening, but we can also perceive the risk of possible pain. So now we've kind of advanced in our anticipatory capabilities, if you will. And you could look, we can look based upon our memories that are stored. We can look at a particular scenario in our mind. We can just imagine doing a particular activity or having a certain object, and then the memories that are associated with pain may indicate to us this is going to be a problem. Now, we're anticipating the risk of pain and shying away from it. Oftentimes you hear people talk about fear, that they're afraid of fear. They fear the fear. Anxiety attacks are like that. They're afraid of the fear of the anxiety attack. So you can really see how advanced this warning system is becoming because it's been practiced so often. Worry is this tendency to anticipate problems and pain. And so That's why people get locked into that. The challenge is that worry is causative. People think they're just, you know, they're protecting themselves. They're actually planting weeds that are going to produce a harvest that they're not interested in. They're causing a condition that they do not want, but they think worry is helping them by anticipating pain. Not so. We can look at the survival impulses. The idea that we're going to perceive pain, then we perceive the risk of pain, and then we perceive the environment that may contain the risk of pain, and then we can keep adding these levels of anticipation of negative possibilities that we now have created this prison, if you will, of energy that is surrounding us, presumably to protect us. But after a while, we're so overprotected by our fears that we're imprisoned by them. We're held back by them. When we experience fear and these memories are triggered, our survival is threatened, we tend to be limited to one of three different approaches. Depending on our memories, we could say, you know, our memories could suggest that we have a better chance of surviving if we fight the threat that we perceive is connected to producing the pain. And so then we go into the fight response. If we have memories that suggest to us that our survival chances are enhanced if we would run away, then we're going to flee from the factor that we believe is causing this threat. And then if the overwhelmment is so dramatic, sometimes it freezes us right on the spot. And that's referred to in trauma research as the freeze response, you know, just stuck in that spot. So now neither the fight nor the flight is activated. Sometimes you hear about that occurring in deer when they get like a deer in the headlights. They don't go, whoa, I got to get out of here, and they continue running one direction or the other. They stop right in their tracks, and not to their benefit nor to the benefit of the person driving that car that ends up hitting them. So that can be really a problem by accessing those kind of memories. Now, I certainly don't understand that as it pertains to deer, but I do understand it as it pertains to human being. So if we've got these memories that say we can dominate a threat, we're going to act in one direction. If we've got memories that say we cannot dominate a threat, we need to run away, that's what we're going to tend to do. So those memories that we access are the key to it. Let's back up a little bit. Stories and memories, who are we? We are the perceivers. That's us. We're the people that perceive these environmental signals. In one form or another, this energy, we perceive it. At a fundamental level, everything is energy, including us, including everything that we perceive, everything we can touch and see and smell and taste, everything. Even thoughts are energy. Memories are energy. Everything is energy. We recognize that if I'm looking at the wall of a hotel room, I recognize that that wall is what I would call solid. That's a solid wall. The floor that I'm standing on, that's a solid floor. Both of the wall and the floor are energy, but they're more solid than, say, the air in between me and the wall. What does that mean? It means the vibrational frequency of the energy of the wall is lower, slower, than the vibrational frequency of the air, of light, of sound, and so on. The different density, the different solidity of objects in our environment are due to the frequency differences. More solid, lower frequency. less solid, less dense, higher frequency. So this is the idea that we want to look at some of the objects and some of the concepts that we experience on a daily basis in terms of this density or solidity. How solid is it? I think all energy can be characterized as electromagnetic. I think that's so. I'm not completely sure it's true. But let's say everything is electromagnetic. And then we can decide that let's create a spectrum or a range. Well, you can make this a horizontal line or a vertical line in which the frequencies are different. Lowest on the left or the bottom and highest on the right or the top, depending on whether you've got a horizontal or a vertical line. This spectrum, this range of electromagnetic energy, is you can Google it and it'll show it to you. And you could say, wow, interesting. In this range of light, of all the possible light forms, only a small segment of that spectrum do human beings perceive consciously. There's so much stuff we cannot perceive with the human eye. You go, And so if you look at the range of electromagnetic energy as it pertains to sound, you'd say, wow, we can only hear a very small range of this energy. And there's a lot of it of higher frequencies and lower frequencies that we can't hear as human beings. Everybody knows that idea in terms of dogs. In terms of sense of smell, and we can use dogs again, there's only a certain range that we can perceive, and other animals can perceive a much greater range than we can. You go, I know that my goal is to increase the range of what I can perceive. I want to be able to perceive more. I want to become more aware. And I think that's true of you and everybody else for that matter, whether we use those kind of words or not. We want to be able to perceive more in the range of energy. If we could perceive more, process more, know more, if we could process it accurately and effectively, that would be great because we do want to become more aware of the energy that we would consider lives and life itself. If you were to turn around and say, if everything is energy and memories are energy, then maybe memories, kind of like light and sound, can be of different vibrations. If we use the word light and we know there are different forms of light that we've labeled that way, different vibrations, different frequencies, and the same with sound. How about memory? Are memories of different vibrations? I would think so, right? Because we could take a high vibration memory and say, when I think of that, I feel lighter, I feel happier, I feel more energized, I'm more engaged in growth and life and willingness to connect to other people and things. Ideas come to me. That's the impact when we connect to that vibration called the high vibration memory. But when we think of a memory that has low vibration, that is discouraging or threatening or disempowering, now all of a sudden the opposite conditions get triggered in us. Discouragement, and we tend to hold back, de-energized, and so on. And you go, well, what do we want to do here? What do we want to do? We want to be able to heal our lower vibration memories, create different stories about them, and then elevate them to higher vibration memories. I have a little diagram that I'd ask you to draw. Draw a horizontal line, and this is going to represent the vibrational frequencies. That's all. And on the left edge, you're going to write lower. And on the right edge, you're going to write higher. So this is the spectrum, if you will. This is the range. And so let's just use words to represent the left edge and use words to represent the right edge. I could say death is on the left. That's a lower vibration. And life is on the right. That's a higher vibration. I could say failure is on the left, success is on the right. Unhappiness is on the left, happiness is on the right. I could say illness is on the left, that lower vibration, and health is on the right, where it would be a higher vibration. I could say destruction is on the left, and construction is on the right. I could say negative is on the left, and positive is on the right. Just words that describe this range. So when we look at vibrational frequencies, we'd say, which ones do I want? Obviously, that list on the right is far more appealing to us than the list on the left. As I said before, energy is electromagnetic on this planet or perhaps in this universe. Thoughts are electromagnetic in nature. They're like a vibration that attracts more vibrations. That's the magnetic part. They will attract like attracts like. We've heard of this as law of cause and effect. You reap what you sow, law of attraction. And the cliches that the birds of a feather flock together has been around for who knows how many centuries. That really represents that idea that like attracts like. This is not new news. You can find things of this sort in the Bible. You know, as a man thinketh, so he is. And, they keep alluding to this idea that thoughts are magnetic. They attract more of the same kind. Now, we know that, and it's pretty well talked about now because of the law of attraction over the last 20 or 30 years. However, a lot of people still don't appreciate what that really means. Even in our medical system, that's not a factor that anybody really pays attention to. Some people believe that physical things cause physical things. So that means that when an unwanted physical thing or a condition exists, the blame or the cause is assigned to some other physical thing. And then the activity to deal with the blamed physical thing is often called treatment. If you live in America and you've ever been treated medically, you're familiar with this process. This is a treatment. Is this cure it? Is this prevent it? Is this no. No, we're taking a physical approach to a physical thing. This is not about curing. This is not about remedying the initial cause. If solid matter is the solidification, is the densification, if you will, of energy, then it's the factor that causes the solidification that should be looked at as causative. What is causing this particular physical manifestation, this density or solidness to occur? That's what we ought to be saying. And what I say is that physical matter is the end result of the solidification of spiritual energy. Or another way to talk about spiritual energy is to describe it with a word called consciousness. Everything that we view is consciousness in one frequency or another. This is explained in great detail in the book Christ Returns, reveals startling truth. Everything is consciousness. Everything. That's the better description of the, rather than the word energy. So this densification, this solidity of consciousness is everything, including ourselves, that we see. And how do we do it? We do it with our thinking and our feeling, our believing. All of that ties in to the stories we tell ourselves and others. We can control how the spiritual consciousness shows up. We direct it. We direct that with our thoughts and our feelings. We're the causes of how that shows up. We can choose the stories, which are really descriptions of our interactions with other forms of consciousness, solid walls and solid floors and so on. And we can make that be any way we want. We can choose the stories that are behind that. We can choose success, and then we can create the story behind that. We can choose health, and we can create the story and tell it to ourselves over and over again. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know that it is your will that we should be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.